I'm William Pachalski, and my favorite thing is Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hey there. Welcome back to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones. It is Sunday, August 2nd, and I've had a pretty good week. I hope you have too. This week was my first ever COVID test. City of Chicago has free testing, mostly on the south and west side. So I hopped on the bus and went out to Logan Square last week. They offer testing in Kelvin Park. I was able to get a same day window for my appointment. And I tested at like 4 p.m. on a Tuesday, and I got my negative results on by 8 p.m. on Wednesday. So if you are in Chicago and trying to figure out how to get tested, the city testing is fast, efficient, free, worth getting on the bus for to go to a neighborhood you don't live in. And it's the oral swab, so it is not super painful. It's not the brain pokey one that we all saw at the beginning of COVID. And by the time this comes out, I will have seen my parents for the first time since COVID started. Probably actually the first time since Christmas. We had March visits planned, and then the great pause happened. So on the show today, this is an interview with William Pachalski. We had this on July 11th. That was a week where I interviewed a lot of people, so I have a little bit of a backlog. William and I went to Millikan University together. He's the second of what I think will be like many Millikan people that I interview for this podcast, because what a fun excuse to talk to people that I haven't had sometimes long conversations with in over 20 years. But William and I, as you'll find out, were also friends in Chicago, and he helped orchestrate a trip to New York to go see his favorite Broadway musical. That is what we talk about in this episode, his love of this one particular musical, The Great Comet of 1812. We stay really focused on that. So William and I met in college. Millikan used to have these apartments called Millikan East and West that were, I don't know, buildings with maybe 16 apartments in it each. And I think William and I lived across the hall from each other my senior year. I'd come back from Argentina. I wasn't an RA anymore. That to me was pretty devastating, pretty big loss of identity. One of the first of many times when my identity was wrapped up entirely in my job and not in my personhood. But we became very fast friends my senior year. And then I moved away to Colorado. We didn't really stay in touch. And then after I moved back to Chicago, I was crossing Lake Street one day, Lake and Wabash, right underneath where the L and the loop turns the corner. Crossing the street, saw William. We stood on the sidewalk and talked to each other. And then that's kind of when we became adult friends again. Before he moved to Portland, in Portland now he owns the Portland Psychic School, which does offer online classes in meditation and clairvoyance, helping people reconnect with their intuition. You don't have to be in Portland to take classes from him, which is really exciting. While he was in Chicago, a couple of the shows that he produced that you hear him talk about, one was The Assassins, which is a Stephen Sondheim musical about people who assassinated or attempted to assassinate U.S. presidents. It's a strange musical because it's a series of monologues. It's a series of solos from each of the different assassins' perspectives. And then he did this amazing show. It was kind of a last hurrah in Chicago before he made the move to Portland. And it was called The One Who Got Away. And he brought in musicians and actors to read monologues and then perform beautiful songs all about lost love and the one who got away. So William really has this just phenomenal artistic aesthetic and production ability. He and I both worked in events, he for much longer. So yeah, so this is William and I talking about Natasha and Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812. It's based on a few pages in War and Peace. It is a beautiful musical that I really hope gets a revival or a national tour in the future when we go to the Life Theater again, because it is, it's a stunning piece of work, and it was a real shame that it closed when it did. It closed too soon. So I hope that you are able to stay home, stay safe, keep telling people about your favorite things.
Hello and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is a podcast where we explore what are people's favorite things and give recommendations without using algorithms. Today, I am so excited to be with one of my dear friends from Millikan University, from college, William Pacholsky. William is the owner of the Portland Psychic School. Is that what it's called?
Yes.
William is the owner and founder of the of the Portland Psychic School, which is in Portland, Oregon. We're talking today. He's in his brand new space. It's beautiful and stunning. Hi, William. How are you doing today?
You know, I'm really good. I'm so excited to be here. And I'm even more excited about what you asked me to come on and talk about.
I am too. I am very excited. But before we get into your favorite thing that we're here to talk about today, I'm curious, how has the great pause been for you? How are you doing?
That's a great question. You know, I'm good. Everything sort of hit in March, right? When things sort of, everybody was like, wait, what's happening? We have to stop. I thought of it for myself as a really great opportunity to, like you said, just sort of pause and revisit choices that I was making, things that I was doing in my life. And, you know, I think in a time of crisis, things that are non-essential start to fall away. And there were some relationships in my life. And I don't just mean relationships with people, but relationships with things and activities and hobbies and whatever that just all of a sudden seemed kind of non-essential. So I started letting all that stuff go, which has been actually a real gift.
Good. And you are, I mentioned, hopefully I didn't edit it out, that you're sitting in a beautiful new office space.
Yeah.
Which is, it's a strange time to be moving into new offices, but are you in downtown Portland? Does Portland have a downtown?
It is. Yeah. Portland does actually have a downtown.
Okay.
Yeah, I would not advise anyone plan a major commercial office move during a global pandemic.
Fair. Solid advice.
We could do a whole bunch of story. I could do a whole conversation about all the crazy stories I have from that. But, you know, last year, Portland Psychic School, we decided to move into sort of our dream facility. And it was a 18-month process finding the right space and getting the build out and doing everything. And we were set to move in May 1st. So mid-March, we were just starting to pack and just starting to get ready to move. And we signed a 15-year lease. And it's a huge financial investment for us and a big risk. And it was a really interesting time to be taking that step.
Yeah.
But we've done it. We've done it. We're here. We're in the space. I'm so excited. I can't wait till someday people can come appreciate it. Hopefully by next year, maybe.
Memorial Day is my new hope for travel.
Yeah, that feels about right. I was thinking March, April, May.
Yeah. I think that by Thanksgiving, we'll maybe spend a little bit more time indoors locally. Mm-hmm. And then Memorial Day is when I hope to get on a plane again.
That sounds, I'll buy that. You'll I'll take that. Bet? Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay.
I'd like to be on a plane by next Memorial Day too.
Yeah, I know you're not on Facebook, but my Facebook memories of like this kind of early July period is just like, oh, remember 5 years ago when you were in London and last year when you were in Israel? And this is really a time when I travel a lot. And so Facebook's really just put in my face that my travel right now is from my living room to my kitchen and back. So...
Yeah, this is, I think, because I started producing and directing corporate events like 15 years ago. I think this is the longest I've ever gone without traveling.
It's weird, right?
I feel a little stir crazy, I have to admit.
I do think one of the things I wish there could have been time for a controlled study on it is to study the like mental health of people who are consultants who live on airplanes and in airports and the impact of that much travel on your body and on your sense of self and what it is doing for people to be grounded for so long. I'm really curious about that because this is also the longest I've February, I was in California. I was in California a week. I had a conference in LA and one in San Diego, and I took the train. Oh, it was so perfect. And then I came home and that's it.
Well, I think also like the effect of that on relationships, I think would be the really interesting sociological study.
People are spending a lot more time with their spouses than they ever have before. Yes.
Where I have felt it most acutely is with my dog, who I now every 3 or 4 weeks have to board or send to the dog sitter for the weekend. Cause I'm not used to having the dog. Like I'm
all
used
the time.
To, like that's where I'm like, oh my God, I can't handle you. I need 3 days off.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine what that would be like if I was married.
Right. Yeah. That's something I've heard in the office is people are just like, I would say at 20 days, people were already hitting.
Yeah.
We have now spent more consecutive nights in the same bed than in our whole marriage.
Right.
So people are really getting pushed, I think, to their like Play-Doh.
Well, I think that's an interesting point to make and might be an interesting segue if I can help you segue into our conversation. The effect of that also on performing artists who are used to being validated or, you know, having performing for others for applause or whatever, you know, like as something that really feeds them. And I've been watching my actor friends and theater friends and music friends, really struggle. Like if your whole life has been built around that, what is that? You can't do it. What does that mean?
Yeah. So let's do the reveal. What is the favorite thing that you're here to talk about today?
My favorite thing that I'm here to talk about today, and it is one of my, I would say, definitely top 10, if not top 5 favorite things in my whole life, is the Great Comet of 1812. Actually, it's called Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812, which is a musical by Dave Malloy.
Yes. And one that you introduced me to. You mm-hmm. you got a group of people together when it was making its Broadway debut, and mm-hmm. you got people really from all over the country to meet up with you in New York for a weekend to sit on stage and take in this amazing piece of art. So for people who have not had did not get to see it, tell us a little bit about what The Great Comet is.
So and this is the way Dave describes it, is it's an electro pop opera based on like 100-page section of War and Peace. And it's more of an opera than a musical, actually. I think it's almost all sung. There's like, I think, 2 spoken lines in the whole show.
Yeah.
So it's really more of an opera than a musical. But it's an incredible piece. It started at Arts Nova. It was commissioned, I think, by Arts Nova back in like 2010 or 11. I don't have the exact timeline, but it opened there at Arts Nova in 2012.
And Arts Nova is New York.
Yeah, it's like an experimental theater lab in New York.
Because it went New York, Boston, New York, right? Was there a Boston?
Yeah,
part,
yeah. Oh, look at you. You
Smash?
Know your Great Comet history. And I have seen it in all these places. So
I only know it because you saw it in all those places.
I got so obsessed with this musical when I went and saw it. And I'll tell the story of seeing it for the first time. But I got so obsessed that I went back to see it. So it started at Ars Nova. Sorry, it's not Arts Nova. It's Ars Nova, which is the name of the company, in 2012. It moved uptown to just sort of just off Times Square in a tent. They did it in a tent. They erected this tent on this abandoned lot in 2013, and it ran there. And then it moved it moved to the Meatpacking District, and then it moved to the tent. Sorry, it's so convoluted.
Okay.
So it moved a couple times.
And it was always a very immersive.
Yes.
Like it happened around and within the audience. You were always dangerously close to the dancers.
Yeah. What was so, and Rachel Shavkin was the director, and what I think she did that was so, and this is part of what made my heart pound the minute I was there, is that it was sort of done not only in the round, but kind of immersively. So you were sitting at these little cocktail tables and the actors were literally pulling up a stool next to your table and doing a scene with another actor. And the whole space was configured so that you could see everything from everywhere. And it was just very immersive. It was really cool.
what location was it? Circus tent the first time you saw it? Was it Meatpacking, Ars Nova? Tell me about the first time you saw it, and who recommended you to get tickets?
Oh, that's great. Yeah. So it was 2013. I had just finished producing and directing a musical in Chicago called Assassins by Stephen Sondheim. And that was super fun. It was kind of a lifelong dream of mine to produce and direct my own sort of semi-professional show. And I spent 2 years working on that and had finished it. And the music director for that show, his name is Robert Aulis, and he's a very active music director in Chicago and all around great guy. We were sort of talking. I think we went out for a drink after the show was over, and I was kind of looking for my next project. And I was like, I don't know, like, I don't feel very inspired. And he was like, oh, I was just in New York and I saw this show and you should check it out. He's like, I think you would like it. And it's funny how innocuous, I don't think he knew, even recommending it, that it would become like a rabid obsession of mine.
Yeah.
And he recommended it. And I happened to be going to New York a couple of weeks later to go see shows, which is something that I used to do pre-COVID.
Right.
Indulge my Broadway addiction. And I went. So this was in, they called it Casino. It was in the tent just off of Times Square. And it was like dinner. They served like pierogi. You know, it takes place in Russia. So they served pierogies and vodka at the table during the show. And it was just this really cool thing. And I went in and I sat down, and from the first 5 minutes, it was like, I was like, I don't know what this is or what this is even going to be, but it's, and maybe some of your other guests have talked about this. I was like, I feel like this thing is already a part of me, even though I've never seen it or experienced it. Like, it was like something from inside of me happening outside of me.
And you went in cold. You had the recommendation.
Yeah.
And you just got your ticket and went.
I knew it was about War and Peace. And I was like, oh, yeah. Like, I don't know. I've never read War and Peace. And like, I mean, who does, right?
Only liar. It's the same people who read Infinite Jest. There are five of them. The other 10 lied. Nobody reads it.
I think that's true. So I went in cold and I saw it. And you know, it was everything. It was the environment. It was the way it was staged. It was the actors. And we can talk about that if you want. Like, the actors that were in it were just incredible and so well cast. Philippa Sue, who everyone knows now as Eliza Hamilton, she played the female lead, Natasha. And I saw her in the tent in 2013. Amazing. Before anybody knew who she was. You know, I think that was right around the same time that Hamilton was workshopping and sort of taking its steps. So she must have been doing both at the same time. So it, like, even looking back on it, what the actors have now gone on to do or to have or to create, it's like there was something kind of special about whatever that environment was for creativity, and just really magic. It felt magical to be a part of it.
So you saw it. So you see it for the first time in the tent.
Yes.
And then did you scrap plans and go see it again the next day?
2 days later, I went back and saw it again. I saw it 2 times in the same weekend. I was like, I can't get enough of this. And then, so I saw it 2 times that weekend. I went home and then I grabbed my friend Kate and I was like, you have to see the show. I'm going to pay for you to come to New York with me to see the show. And I like bought her flight. I got us a hotel room. I got her ticket because I was like, I have to share
you
this
have
with
to have someone. To talk
yes,
to about it. Yeah.
Right. So my friend Kate and I went to New York together and saw it. We saw some other shows while we were there too. But I just kept going back. I think I saw it in the tent. I want to say 4 times I saw it in the tent.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then it goes to Boston.
Yeah. Then
they continue workshopping it, or?
Yeah. I think what happened was they decided that, or they got the backing or something to go to, they were good. The plan was to go to Broadway and to open it in a Broadway theater, which presented, I think, really interesting challenges since it was so immersive. Like, how do you do something that's immersive in a tent, like in a Broadway theater where you've got, you know, 1,000 seats or something. So they brought it up to ART and some of the cast changed and they were tweaking. They were like playing, they added a couple songs. I took some things away. I have very strong opinions about all of that. and so I was like, well, I have to go see this version at ART because they're playing with it. And I felt this strange, you know, the way I think people that get obsessed with things feel this strange sense of ownership with what they're upset. I was like, I feel like I have a stake in this and I need to go make sure they don't mess it up. Even though like what would I do or who would listen to me? But I had to go see what they were doing to it. And so I went, I flew to Boston all by myself. I saw it twice that weekend.
And
it was amazing.
How much of the cast came with it to Boston? Because Dave Malloy stayed Pierre until it was Josh Groban on Broadway, right? Or were there other Pierres?
There were others. He had some understudies that I think started going on more than him. I mean, you got to remember this, it started in 2012. So it's at ART in 2015, which is 3 years later. So some of these actors had been doing this 6, 7, 8 times a week for like 3 years.
Wow.
Which is, I know.
It's a lot.
Because I've never done anything that long.
Nope. And it's a very, a lot of movement, it's a very physical, because I think when you say it's more opera than musical, you start to think operas can be a little bit more.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Slow moving, slow action.
Presentational.
Yes, right. And I would say like a circus tent feel, like there's something very acrobatic about The Great Comet. The people, it is high energy, very physical show.
Well, it's funny that you bring that up, because I just, was it last weekend already? I don't even know when Hamilton came out on Disney Plus. And
yeah, last week.
Invited a bunch of my friends from Portland. Don't tell anyone. We didn't wear masks, but I had like 4 or 5 friends come over to my house. And we watched Hamilton together, which was also wonderful because these are people that didn't get a chance to see the show. And being able to share that with them and the experience of that with those friends was just warmed my heart. You know, it was just great to be in that. But it's funny, at the end of it, they were like, wow, they're doing so much. It's so athletic what they're doing, not only with their voices, but their bodies. And I even said to the group that I was like, yeah. And they were doing that like 8 times a week
for years.
And like, I don't think people realize that these shows, they look exhausting, but they're doing that every day. It's crazy. Twice in one day on matinee days.
Right. And they're still having to get up and you have to do so much yoga and stretching and other, like, that's not all your exercise in the day. You have to do other
things.
No,
they're warming up before the show and they're, you know, like, and on top of that, they're like going grocery shopping and like doing, you know, like there are also people that have lives, you know, it's crazy. Crazy.
All right. So you see it twice in Boston.
Yes.
And you said you have feelings about what stayed and what went out. But let's talk about then it goes to Broadway.
Yeah. So in Boston, they also Philippa Sue bowed out, I think, because that was 2000. So Hamilton was in.
So Hamilton.
And I think she knew she wasn't going to be able to go to Broadway. I have this whole, you know, like I have this story about it in my
head. I'm sure you've had very long conversations in your head with her.
Totally.
She was being interviewed like an internal Google event this week. And a friend who works there texted me. He's like, hey, they're interviewing Philippa Sue right now. Do you have questions for her? So like my first question was like, how good does David Diggs smell in person? And he said, can you give me a question that won't get me fired?
Yeah.
So I was like, ask her about like the experience of working on Great Comet and having to make the decision to go to Hamilton and thoughts about that. I was like, that's a good deep cut that somebody would. So I'm waiting to hear if the question got asked or not.
Well, you have to let me know.
Obviously. Yeah.
Or record it as an addendum to this interview, because I think now we all want to know. So Philippa Sue had I think bowed out at that point, and they brought in Danae Benton, who eventually went to Broadway, and you saw Danae, talk to you about your experience, but
and she eventually became Eliza.
Oh, she did?
On Hamilton.
Oh, I didn't even know that. That's funny.
Oh yeah, she eventually, and I was like, okay, how do I get a ticket to see her as Eliza? Because that would have been that's a role that I think is really hard, because you only get a few songs and.
Oh. But so important to the show.
To see her sing Burn would be a gift. God,
now I got to scour all my dark web Broadway bootleg sites to see if I can find that. So Danae was in it in Boston, and Scott Stangland, I think is his name, who was one of Dave's understudies, was kind of that was the peer I saw that weekend, and he was great. And there were some sub-ins, I think, because people needed some time off before they went to Broadway. I get the feeling that the Boston ART show was more about the staging and trying to figure out how to stage it correctly in a classic proscenium theater rather than what they did worked. And part of what they did was they built out this huge extension to the stage, and then put a lot more seats on stage. And then there was people sort of sitting in the classic seats, and it worked just as well. I thought it was really, really well done.
Yeah, I thought so too. So then it goes to Broadway.
Yes.
And did you see it on Broadway before the night that you took all of us?
I did not.
Okay.
So it, you know, they announced it's going to Broadway. They announced that Josh Groban is going to play Pierre, which everybody was super excited about.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think at that point I felt this weird, I keep going back to this. I felt this weird like ownership of the show because I was so obsessed and loved it so much. And so, you know, I wanted it to be a success and I wanted a lot of my friends to see it and appreciate it and hopefully have the same sort of transcendent experience I did. So I got a bunch of friends together, like you said, and people flew in from all over. And I think there were like 8 of us, I think.
Total. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
And we met for dinner beforehand and then we went to the show and I had not seen Josh or any of the changes they made for the Broadway production before that. So it was like seeing it for the first time, even for me, even though it was like the 7th time that I had seen yeah. it, which was part of the magic.
And it was such a, cause it's an immersive theater experience. You walk in the door and you walked through this Cold War punk tunnel of like Russian propaganda.
Yeah.
I didn't know anything about it other going in. Other than you loved it and I trust you, so we're going. And so it was like this plywood tunnel and we were on the stage and there were risers on the stage. There were like these tables built into the stage. So I was in a seat making eye contact with the keyboard player, like the orchestra was on the stage. And so you were in this, there were these sunken pits on stage. They had built runways out into the audience in the balcony and on the main floor. So when we talk about the acrobatic dancers, they're not just running up and down the aisles. They've built whole new stages to wrap around people when they go out to do this like amazing dance.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, like kind of like a crazy fashion runway kind of setup, like with lots of runways and
yeah.
And then there's like the rave scene where like the strobe lights are on and people are dancing all over like a Russian rave. There's so many styles represented in the music. It's so great.
Yeah. Yeah. So we saw it with Josh Groban.
Mm-hmm. Who you were like 5 feet away from at one point, right?
Yep.
Like, because he was right there in the center of the stage and you were, I think, closest to that.
And then I did go back and see it when Oak took the role.
Yes. Yes.
And I loved him more than I love Josh Groban.
Well, I have to admit, and I don't want any Josh Groban fangirls to come after me, so don't publish my address with this podcast. I prefer Dave Malloy to all of them, honestly. I think it was so his show and it was so his creation. And Josh was a great headliner for Broadway and then Oak and some of the others. I don't know if there was anybody else that came after that. There was the whole Mandy Patinkin fiasco, but I think it just, for me, it never had the same magic as when Dave was sort of doing his own role that he really wrote for himself, I think. Yeah.
So then how many times did you get to see it when it was on Broadway?
Just that once.
That was it.
Yeah. Cause it wasn't on Broadway long. I don't even think it was on Broadway for a full year. I think I could be wrong on that, but Dave did it for a little while, or Josh did it for a little while, and then they brought in Oak. I don't remember the timeline of that, but other things were happening and I didn't get to New York for a little while. And then
they were bringing in like a star name for the the country role. That's a bad way to explain it. He has the solo that's sort of like a Dolly Parton solo.
Sonia Alone.
Yeah.
That's funny. I would never describe it as country. So that's curious that that's how you remember it. But the character of Sonia, they did bring in, I want to say they brought in Ingrid Michaelson, but I think that might be wrong because I think she did Waitress. I can't remember.
Yeah.
They were playing with bringing in different bigger names because I think it's so hard for an independent show like this to sell out a Broadway. I think they were just really struggling to fill the seats. They were like, you know, what can we do to get the kids interested?
And when you're in that was a year with a lot of they were competing against big shows,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Dear Evan Hansen was still open.
Yes.
Hamilton, obviously. Waitress might have still been open.
I like to imagine in my dreams that someday there'll be a really great revival of Great Comet on Broadway, and it'll be at a year where there isn't like 3 other major Tony Award winning shows to compete with, because I think it didn't get seen as much as it should have. But it did get nominated for quite a few awards and it got really, really great reviews. I think the New York Times, Ben Branton and the New York Times loved it. I think people who are passionate about theater were like totally into it, but it was probably hard to get mom and dad with the three girls to go see it, you know?
Yeah. How do you get people who are in New York for a weekend for their possibly only Broadway experience in their life to realize it's a good option?
Right. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, the 14-year-old kids from the Midwest wanting to go see the musical based on War and Peace.
Right. Yeah. It's a hard sell.
It is. It is. And it was. So that was, it was obviously devastating when it closed. I didn't get to go back and see it again. But I think I read recently that it's really popular in Japan. Yeah.
Yeah. It was staged in Japan.
Yeah. And it was like a super big hit. And,
it was all translate. Cause I did imagine how fun that trip would be to go to Japan and see it.
Oh my God. I would go in a heartbeat.
Yeah. But I believe they translated the whole thing into Japanese. They weren't doing super titles. So I feel like that might've, no, I would have enjoyed it. It's so.
Yeah, yeah. No, let's go. Once this is all over, let's go.
Yeah.
I'll go to the ends of the earth to see Great Comet again.
Yeah. How do you think it impacted you in the era when you were getting to see it all the time? And when you, so what do you think it meant to you when you were in that window of getting to see it a lot?
Well, I think because I had just fulfilled this personal dream of producing and directing a musical in Chicago, which, you know, I had gone away from theater for a long time.
Yeah.
And I had sort of come back to it to do that. And theater has always been my first love since I was like 7 or 8. I was doing plays with the neighbor kids in my basements. We would go to Kmart and we would buy Clippy desk lamps, and we would clip them to the beams in the basement to make stage lights.
Yeah.
And I was always fantastic. The director, even when I was 7. And you know, I'd gone away from it for a long time because I had a professional career that kept me so busy and just doing other things. And so I came back to it to do the musical Assassins. And I think I was just so loving being in love with that part of myself again, you know, to find a musical that really spoke to me on a personal level and was so rich in its content and execution. It just was the right time for me to fall in love with something new, you know, like,
yeah.
It just, I don't know, it was divine timing. It was just, I was ready for a new passion, and it filled that slot so easily.
Yeah. I think when I think about it, when I came back from seeing it, was this after Trump was elected?
It was, I believe it was like Christmas, because it was December. I'm pretty sure it was December.
So he had been elected and hadn't been inaugurated.
Correct. So it was like it was after Thanksgiving. So I think it was beginning December 2016. Yeah.
And there's a line towards the end. I think it might be when Pierre comes back and he's like, "Don't you all know there's a war going on?"
Yeah.
That is the line that's, I have paraphrased. That is not the actual line, but that is the spirit of the line that I came back and I wrote it on the front of the playbill, and I put it on a shelf at my desk, and I would look at every day while we, at the time I was working in public relations and doing a lot of silly things with mascots. And I would just think about that line of just like, doesn't anyone realize what's going on? And it does feel like this combination of COVID and the current iteration of the Black Lives Matter protests and talking about defunding police, it feels like more people know there's a war going on than they did at the time.
I think we all knew this was coming, though, back in 2016, right? We didn't know exactly how, but we all knew, and we're not done yet, right?
No,
it's funny, preparing for this interview, or it's just sort of thinking about it, I wrote down a couple of like juicy nuggets from the show, or like my favorite parts, and that line is, I think, my favorite line from the show.
Yeah.
Because the character of Andre is like kind of a MacGuffin through the whole show. Like Natasha's engaged to him and you hear about him, and like everyone's talking about Andre, who's off fighting the war and blah, blah, blah.
And Andre isn't here.
Yeah, right. That's one of the opening lines, right? And Andre's not there through the whole show. And this whole like childish drama kind of happens in a way, the, you know, I guess you could say like the silliness of the bourgeoisie, right? Of all these things, mm-hmm. while like they're fighting Napoleon, you know, and yeah. it's like all these people are having these crazy dramas in the show, and it's all like backstabbing and this and this. And then Andre gets back and is like, what are you guys doing? Like there's, I've been off fighting a war. Like, why am I even dealing with this? You know? So it's a powerful moment, I think, in the play, because it's like, what if this is actually real?
Yeah. Yeah. How are you distracting yourselves with this petty love story?
Right.
So what's another juicy bit that you wrote down?
Well, one of the things that always struck me seeing the show is that the name of the show is The Great Comet of 1812. Mm-hmm. It's in the name. It's like you buy the ticket. You're like, I want a ticket to the Great Comet of 1812.
Yeah.
Right. Except they don't talk about the comet until the last 5 minutes of the play.
Yeah.
Which it's so funny. Like you get so wrapped up. It's kind of what we were just talking about. Like from the very first moment, you get wrapped up in these characters and their sordid lives and, you know, like all the intricate dramas and things happening between them. And it's, I remember the first time I saw it, when they introduced the comet at the very end, and they did so in such a really cool way with this like Sputnik satellite lamp, mm-hmm. Which felt very appropriate to the Russian imagery in the show. But when they bring up the comet at the very end, Pierre sings about the comet and the sort of psychological and psychic significance of a comet and how it portends great change. And you realize that the whole time during the show, you'd forgotten about the comet. So it's really kind of like this Deus Ex Machina moment where like you realize that all of the drama in the show that you've been so wrapped up in the best way, is just like this weird, you know, couple months in history. And that is the march of human time, right? Like we caught up in these things that are happening. I would say even some of the stuff that's going on in the world right now, like it's so urgent. It's so important. And it is, except in 100 years, it's just going to be like this weird chapter in a book about this time, right? And we're going to seem so distant from it. So I always like, that was one of the things that was just always so powerful to me about the show, is that how easily you forget it's about the Great Comet. And then at the very end, they kind of bring it in as the Deus Ex Machina to tie it all together.
Yeah. The scenes that I revisit, like before going on a trip, or the one that we sit down before, the song about like stopping before you go on a trip, like Russian sit down.
Right.
It's just a moment. It's not even the whole song. It's right before Troika, right? Yeah.
Yep.
And it's just this high energy song. They're getting ready. There's going to be an elopement or a kidnapping, depending on
depending who on your you are
in the story.
Right.
And they're getting, it's this very high energy song, preparing, making sure that you have enough shawls because she'll be cold. She'll be in her nightgown.
Right.
And then everybody, the whole cast stops and sits down to breathe, because that's what Russians do before they leave the house or before they go on a trip. And there's this really, did you ever see Anastasia?
Yeah, of course.
When it was on either the okay. Did you see it on stage?
I saw the movie. I actually did not see it on Broadway. No, I did not see the musical.
You saw the Meg Ryan movie.
Yes.
So one of the outcomes of my Hamilton obsession was I got tickets to Broadway in Chicago and started seeing, you know, 5 to 8 shows a year since then. Right. So that's like the great gift of Hamilton to me, was just becoming an active theater goer in Chicago instead of someone who actively regretted missing shows. And right. So Anastasia is also the story of getting out of Russia and going to France.
Right.
And there's this moment in the Broadway show where they're like stopping and saying goodbye to Russia. Mm-hmm. That I don't know, I'm probably one of 3 people that connected it to that moment in The Great Comet, but it was, that is something that's really stuck with me. Mm-hmm. And the song We Write Letters. Yeah. Like every time I get a postcard or I write a handwritten letter to people, I think of We Write Letters.
I think that song is so funny. And you know, the lyrics of it are, in 19th century Russia, we write letters, we put down in writing what is happening in our minds. And I always thought that was so funny, because like, you do actually have to explain that to people.
Right.
Like, instead of making Facebook posts or just posting our commentary and our thoughts on social media, like people actually used to write letters, and like you would have to wait a week to get a response from someone to your thoughts, you know? Funny. Yeah, the sitting down thing is great because, you know, Dave Malloy, when he was writing it, and I've, you know, obviously picked apart every lyric, but I think he had a lot of fun putting in obscure Russian cultural references into the show. And that is I read an interview with him sometime where he talked about that as like an actual old Russian custom where before you leave the house, you sit down and kind of ground yourself, take a breath, and then you go. And wouldn't it be wonderful if we all did that now?
Yeah.
Other than rushing.
Yeah, the leaving the house part.
Yeah. Yeah. Or the, no. All of it, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. No, it's a great, it's such a powerful moment. And especially during the show, because it is a loud song that's happening right before. Organic. And then they just sit.
Yes.
And it just cuts all action. Mm-hmm. And if you're in one of those stage seats, you really feel that they are all heaving.
Yeah. Like, these are
some of the most fit people in New York, and they are like out of breath from the song that comes before that.
It's intense, very frenetic.
Yeah. Any other moments that you wrote down?
No, those are my big ones. I think the lasting effect of this musical on me is that it actually gave me an inroad and an appreciation to War and Peace, which I've actually read half of now. And there was a BBC miniseries in 2015 or 16, I think, with Lily James and some other really great contemporary actors. Paul Dano plays Pierre. And so, like, it actually opened up the world of War and Peace and Tolstoy to me in a way, because I, you know, sometimes I think works of literature or cultural stuff like that, it's so dense and it's so out of time that it's hard to read something like that and feel a personal connection to it. Right. And so now that I sort of knew the characters involved in this 100-page slice of the novel, I went back and started reading it. I only got about halfway, but I felt it was easier for me to read the novel. And it's just an incredible story, and it really stands up to the test of time, because each of the characters are so passionately written and so illustrative, I think, of different parts of people's lives or the challenges people go through in their lives, even today in contemporary culture. So I think the lasting gift is that it really made, at least to me, and I'm hoping maybe others, this, you know, great classic piece of literature a little bit more accessible by sort of speaking to it in the present tense, you know, because I love it.
Yeah.
You know, looking back when this was all happening, I was like in my mid-late 30s. Mm-hmm. And I think what I didn't realize at the time in my own psyche was that Pierre's quest, and it's kind of all about Pierre's quest to find what's worth living for, or what's meaningful about life, and how do you throw aside, you know, cultural and social rules in order to have what you want, or love what you want to love, or have the love that you know you deserve. And his story is about sort of getting out of his funk and finding what's worth living for. I didn't know it at the time, but I think that's kind of what I was doing. Okay. And that's why, to me, in that time when I was reconnecting to theater, you know, like, well, what do I want the rest of my life to be about? And what is worth loving and putting my love into? And I got some answers about that from myself. But I think this musical came at the perfect moment for my journey. And I don't know that I would have recognized that when it was happening, but in hindsight, it was a step that helped me along my way. And I think that's what art should do.
Yeah, I agree. It's one of those, when you're in it, it feels like Natasha's the main character because she's the drama and action is hers. But it's Pierre trying to figure out, like, where is his life going and how did he get there? And so when you step out of the theater, you realize how much of it is his psychological journey and emotional journey, even though it's around the, like, the catalyst for that reflection is Natasha, this young woman, early 20s, maybe 19.
Yeah, I think they were,
Or late teens.
Yeah, they were quite young in the book, right?
Right. That it's easy to dismiss it as like a teenage soap opera.
Right.
Dismiss, that's a bad phrase, but it is.
Well, it's easy to get wrapped up in it. Yeah. Like we were talking about Andre coming back, being like, don't you guys realize there's a war going on? Mm-hmm. Like all of this childish, like who's breaking up with who and who's betrothed to who and blah, blah, like what is the relevance of that? And there's that other underlying like relationship. I mean, what happens in the book after this 100-page slice or whatever of War and Peace is, you know, eventually Natasha and Pierre end up together and have children together and end up in love. And so what? Really you're seeing sort of the, I know, spoiler wow. alert.
Okay.
Yeah. So they end up, what you realize in the book is, you know, they were in love the whole time, but the love that they had was so, and this was Tolstoy's commentary, I think, the love they had was so real that no one named it as love because yeah. love was so superficial at that time in the aristocracy and the bourgeoisie that it was about fortunes right. and marriages of convenience and marriages for position. And here's these two people that every time they're in the room together, they're just like madly in love with each other, except no one will call it that right. because that's not what love was at that right. time.
Love was a contract or business arrangement.
Right, right. So it takes them decades to eventually be like, oh, it was you all along. And they wow. wind up happily ever after in a way.
I would watch that part too.
Dave Malloy, you should do a sequel. Yeah. Has there ever been like a Broadway musical sequel to another Broadway musical? I don't think so.
Yeah. Another great detail of the movie that I'm trying to think of how to, it's not a movie. So of the musical is that Andre becomes his father.
Yeah.
But it's also, I've had some friends going through some things where their father and then their brother were taking on so many of the same characteristics where yeah. I was just like, I feel like the only way I can support you on this is if first you go see The Great Comet and then we can talk about what happens to Andre after the war and right. his relationship to his father. And so that was like an incredible metaphor of like intergenerational trauma that I was just like, if you had seen it, I could be so much more supportive of a friend of you right now because it's all I can think about.
Well, and what a genius way to write that and stage that was having the actor yeah. play the father at the beginning and then the son at the end.
Okay. So at the beginning, you said you have opinions, songs that were taken out or added. What are things from the that you saw in the circus tent that I didn't see that you think are missing? Or what are those changes that you have strong feelings about?
Well, there were two things that I can call out. One is that when I saw it at casino in the tent, in the scene where Natasha and Andre's sister marry me for the first time, as Andre mm-hmm. betrothed, she goes to meet Andre's family. And the sister Mary is this pious, very Russian Orthodox, you know, yeah. Christian do-gooder. And their back and forthing, their like first meeting is so venomous and biting. And they softened it for Broadway. They softened the lyrics a little bit and they sort of made it less caustic, which I think really affected the trajectory of those characters. I thought it, you know, I think they did it because they didn't want it to be so mean, but there were like lyrical changes and changes in that scene that I thought took away from the power of it. So that was just disappointing to me. And, you know, like when you're so obsessed with something, I mean, I've memorized every note. So to hear new words 3 years later, I'm like, that's wrong. Like that, that's not as effective as it was the way I memorized it. Right. So there's that. And then they added a solo number for Josh Groban in the Broadway. I think they played with a couple different versions of it at ART. And they added this solo called Dust and Ashes, which is sort of Pierre's soliloquy. And I don't like it at all.
Well, that's so funny.
And I've tried. I've been like, no, this is like Pierre's big moment. I got to give it. And every time I listen to it, I'm like, nope, not interested.
Because that song is essentially just a Yom Kippur sermon.
Ah, right.
Like it is so Jewish that, if you're a friend of mine who also came with us that night, Ezra, did a playlist of like Yom Kippur Broadway songs.
And that was on it.
That was like number one. It was like the number one most obvious song about Yom Kippur was Dust and Ashes.
I can see that. I think the message of the song is beautiful. And I think some of the lyrics in it are poetically written.
Yeah.
But it feels like to me, and maybe this is just because I've memorized it a certain way and that's not part of the way I memorized it.
Yeah.
It feels like this weird like moment of stopping, which is what a soliloquy is. You stop the action of the play and you say something. But it feels, it to me, it gets in the way of the movement of the text and sort of the dramatic arc.
Yeah.
those are my two, I don't know, like, who am I to have criticisms of the show? But those are my two parts that I'm like, I don't like it.
Right. But if you're bringing in celebrities into that role, then you've got to give them something to like.
Oh, I mean, Josh Groban needed a solo. Yeah. Otherwise, why do you have Josh Groban in the show? I mean, what's the point?
Right. So. Yeah. I wish you had gotten to see Oak in that role.
I would have loved to.
So for people listening who don't know, he was in the original cast of Hamilton as Mulligan Madison. Mm-hmm. And then he went from Hamilton to The Great Comet as Pierre, and seeing him play this old man, or play it as an old man, I just thought he brought so much to the role. And I was, you know, I understand that he wasn't yet the draw that they needed for the role,
right?
And I understand why they wanted to get Mandy Patinkin in, and really wish they hadn't fumbled the pass.
Yeah, that's the disappointing part of that whole thing. I just think it either, and I don't know, you know, none of us were in the room where it happened.
Yeah.
So I mean, we can all have opinions and comments on it, but none of us were on those phone calls or those meetings. And I think they clearly didn't do a good job of explaining what they were doing to Oak.
Yeah.
Right. Or his agent or whatever. And, you know, it led to this whole kerfuffle, which actually, you know, ended up closing sort of ending
the show.
Which is just so disappointing, because it could have been so much.
Yeah.
I would have loved to have seen Mandy Patinkin in it too. Like, that would have been, I would have flown back to New York just to see that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was looking forward to collecting Pierre's the way that I've collected Hamilton's and having opinions about how, you know, Lynn is the weakest Hamilton of them all.
Oh my God. You said it.
Yeah. So what is your, you know, dream next show that you want to be able to see when all this is back, other than a revival of Great Comet?
I look forward to the day that I can fly to New York for a week and see six shows and participate in that glorious, glorious thing that happens only in New York. And I've been everywhere else. I've been to London. I see shows in London when I go. I see shows in Chicago. I see touring companies in Portland and in San Francisco when they come through. But there's just nothing like being in New York and seeing a show on Broadway. And I can't wait till, you know, we're in a place where that's back up and running, for the sake of those artists and those professionals that, you know, they're at the top of their field. And I don't know, that's just got to be so hard.
Yeah. I think people recognize that the Olympics getting moved a year, how that impacts the athletes. But I don't think people realize how it impacts Broadway actors, dancers. There's the financial side that I think people are starting to have some understanding of, the financial impact. But and you talked a little bit about even just like the mental health impact of performers not getting that identity validation of an audience.
No. And like, you know, college students graduating with performing arts degrees right now, like this is when you would be moving. You'd be doing all the, you know, interviews with agents and showcases and, you know, like, I've been training. This is my whole life and I'm ready to step into this dream, and that is just not there right now. That's just, I can't even imagine what that must feel like.
Right.
So I can't wait to go to New York and support all that beautiful art again.
I look forward to it. So thank you, William. This has been wonderful. It's always a joy to talk to you, but especially to get to spend an hour plus talking about The Great Comet.
I thank you for having me on, and it brought back so many great memories of you coming to see it and that magical night that we all shared. And Dave Malloy is such an amazing artist that I'm always excited to talk him up to people, because the show's so good. But he's written a number of other shows that are also really, really great, and they're all on Spotify, so you can go listen to them.
Oh, nice. Is there anything that you would like to promote or plug? Or
go see live theater. That's my promotion to everybody. There's just that unique thing that happens in the, you know, the room where it happens. I literally can't not reference Hamilton, right? As everything gets more digital and more online, and we're seeing that in the workplace, right? Like, people like remote work and all that, like, there's just no substitute for the power and the passion and the impact of live theater. Like, it just, it lights up something inside of the human spirit that I think is irreplaceable. So I will be beating that drum for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
That's my plug.
Great. Well, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.